stars and stripes. Dumpster fire vibe. Come on. All American why? All American why? All American why? Ask yourself the American why.
Hello, my excessive thinkers. Let's not warm up. Let's go. Somewhere along the way in the United States, being aware of injustice became more controversial than injustice itself. That is not an accident. That is the episode. Why did woke become the enemy instead of injustice? Because this country has a long documented habit of reacting badly when someone explains how the system actually works. So first, let's clear the air. Woke didn't start as an insult. It didn't start as a political ideology. It didn't start as a college class, a DEI consultant, or a PowerPoint slide. The term woke did not come from social media or corporate diversity trainings. It comes from Black American vernacular, rooted in survival, political awareness, and lived experience. One of the earliest documented uses appears in 1938 when blues musician Huddy Ledbetter warned Black audiences to stay woke while discussing the Scottsboro Boys case. That case involved 9 Black teenagers falsely accused of rape and subjected to racist policing, sham trials, and near certain execution. In that context, woke was not a slogan or an identity. It was survival advice. Pay attention, stay alert, do not trust the system to protect you. That warning proved tragically prescient. In 1955, Emmett Till, a 14-year-old Black boy from Chicago, was kidnapped, tortured, and murdered in Mississippi after being falsely accused of offending a white woman. His killers were acquitted by an all-white jury, despite overwhelming evidence and later admitting their guilt that they made up the verdict. Till's mother, Marnie Till Mobley, insisted on an open casket funeral so that the country would be forced to see what racial terror actually looked like. Staying awake was not abstract. It was about staying alive. During the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 1960s, the term resurfaced informally among organizers and community members. To be woke meant understanding how segregation, policing, housing policy, employment discrimination, and voter suppression work together. It aligned with Black political education, even when the word itself was not always front and center. In 1962, novelist William Melvin Kelly wrote in the New York Times Magazine that woke was a term used in Black communities to mean being informed and aware of social realities. By then, the word had already carried decades of meaning. The term never disappeared. Through the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, it lived in Black communities, music, spoken word, and organizing. It was communal language, not academic language. In 2008, Erykah Badu brought the phrase to a broader audience with her song, Master Teacher, which included the refrain, I Stay Woke. It framed woke as spiritual, political, and liberatory. In the 2010s, the word re-entered mainstream visibility through Black Lives Matter activism, following the killings of Trayvon Martin in 2012, Michael Brown in 2014, and many others. Stay woke became a call to remain vigilant about police violence, misinformation, and structural racism. Only later did the term become flattened, commercialized, and politicized. Its Black roots were stripped away. What began as a warning about power became a catch-all insult used to shut down conversations about racism, history, and inequality. At its core, woke has always meant the same thing. Pay attention to what really is happening, especially when systems are designed to lie to you. Its original purpose was awareness, which historically has never gone over well in the United States. Race is not a footnote in U.S. history. It is infrastructure. Enslavement was legal from 1619 until 1865. Segregation was enforced by law through Jim Crow until the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Redlining, which determined who could buy homes and build wealth, was not outlawed until the Fair Housing Act of 1968. So when people react defensively to the word woke, what they are often reacting to is not the word itself. They're reacting to the discomfort of being asked to notice how the system actually worked, and in many ways still does. When awareness is framed as dangerous, those with power never have to justify the outcomes they benefit from, and the effects are measurable. Today, the median white household holds roughly 6 to 8 times the wealth of the median Black household. Black women are 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes. Black Americans face higher exposure to environmental toxins and harsher criminal sentencing. Those are not opinions, those are federal statistics. And every time those numbers are named, backlash follows. Let's talk about the civil rights leaders we now sanitize. Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, and John Lewis are often framed today as very different figures. In real time, they were treated the same. King was deeply unpopular while alive. In 1966, nearly 2/3 of Americans disapproved of him. When he spoke out against the Vietnam War in 1967, newspapers accused him of undermining national unity. The FBI surveyed him extensively under COINTELPRO. Malcolm X was portrayed as violent and un-American, even as he reframed the Black freedom struggle as a global human rights issue. He was assassinated in 1965 at the age of only 39. John Lewis is now remembered for good trouble, but when he made that good trouble, it was criminalized. At 25, he was beaten on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965. He was arrested more than 40 times and told repeatedly to wait. Different tones, same treatment. We praise justice movements once they are safe and historical. While they're active, they're called decisive. That pattern repeated with affirmative action. Affirmative action emerged in the 1960s through executive orders under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson to address explicit, legally enforced exclusion in education and employment. This was not subtle discrimination. This was discrimination written in law. By the 1970s, backlash crystallized in the Supreme Court case, Regents of the University of California v. Bach, decided in 1978. The court ruled that strict racial quotas were unconstitutional, but that race could still be considered as one factor among many. The nuance did not survive the public conversation. Affirmative action stopped being framed as correction. It became framed as discrimination itself. Once again, injustice disappeared. The response to injustice became the controversy. Then came critical race theory. Most people never encountered it directly, but after 2020, it became a convenient label for discomfort. And this is where the absurdity became the policy. Beginning in 2021, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis launched what he openly called a war on woke. Not a war on discrimination, not a war on inequality, a war on awareness. Between 2021 and 2023, Florida passed and enforced laws restricting how race, history, and systematic inequality could be discussed in K-12 schools, universities, and workplaces. Courses were reviewed or eliminated. Diversity, equity, and inclusion programs were defunded. Public institutions were warned against teaching concepts deemed too uncomfortable. The word became the threat. No definitions, just fear. Because once awareness itself is framed as dangerous, injustice never has to be defended. And here is the tell. There is no sustained outrage about the racial wealth gap, no emergency coverage for maternal mortality disparities, no countdown clocks for unequal school funding. There is outrage about people talking about those things. That is not confusion, that is strategy. At some point, woke stopped meaning awake and started functioning as a conversational kill switch. It is easier to fight a word than to fix a system. cheaper too, and it pulls better. And here's the quiet truth underneath it all. Most people did not wake up wanting to be woke. They woke up wanting fairness, safety, dignity, and opportunity. Those are not radical demands. But calling them woke makes them easier to dismiss without accountability. And that is why today's conversation matters. Because this is not really about a word. It is about how language gets weaponized to redirect fear, shut down empathy, and keep inequality exactly where it is. And that is why I'm so glad to be joined today by Sherry Dunn, author of Qualified, How Competency Checking and Race Collide at Work, whose work shows how these patterns show up right now in our workplaces, our leadership structures, and our everyday assumptions about who is qualified. Well, Sherry, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing this podcast.
Happy to be anywhere.
What a time, right?
Yeah, what a time to be alive.
Yeah, so this episode, the question, the why is, why did woke become the enemy instead of injustice? Mm-hmm. Just from that question alone, does anything come to you?
Oh, so many things come to me, you know, but I think woke, the word, is just like equal justice or, you know, affirmative action or any of the other words. Or, and I talk about this in my book, there's a history of people who oppose advancement doing this with words. And the two famous ones I talk about in the book are carpetbagger and scallywag. So to the extent anybody's ever heard of the words carpetbagger and scallywag, they've only heard of them maybe from watching Gone with the Wind. And it sounds like carpetbaggers were really bad people and scallywags are bad people. But in point of fact, carpetbaggers were Northerners who went into the South after the end of slavery to help institute equal rights for African Americans. And scallywags were Southern whites, who, some of whom had fought in the war, who took the position that, you know, we should just try to make this work and extend equal rights. And they took their work and re-characterized it as anti-Southern, as opportunists, and took the terms carpetbagger, which really just meant they had these like suitcases that were made out of carpet, and scallywags, and made it a bad thing. And then everything associated with that was a bad thing. So making woke bad is just an extension of what has happened with terminology. Every time there's terminology or people who are trying to address injustice. So. Mm-hmm.
Well, and, you know, woke seems to be a word now associated with all things they don't like. Mm-hmm. Why do you think people use a word to do that? Is it easy for them? Is it convenient for them? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, it's a stand-in, right? I mean, the Claremont Institute is an institute based in California that has spent years trying to reframe language in the negative. So this modern work has been going on since civil rights legislation passed, which is to make affirmative action something bad. And say it has attributes it does not. And so you have folks like the folks at the Claremont Institute and the Heritage Foundation and others who understand the power of rhetoric. I mean, one thing I will say is like those groups really understand the power of rhetoric. They understand what it means to take a word and reframe it and destroy it to destroy its power, right? Yeah. Woke, as you probably know, is a word from the African American community that is much older than this current thing. People would say, you know, stay woke, which means stay alert, stay engaged, stay connected. And that, so it has a older etymology for like, you know, Black lingo beyond today. But what I often say to people is, why would somebody want you to be asleep? Because that's the opposite of woke, right? So if you're so upset with people being awake to things, what are you actually saying? What you're actually saying is, I want you to be asleep to what I'm doing. And so it's a stand-in, you know. So the Claremont Institute, there's a great article in the New York Times a couple of years ago about this. They said, don't say you're against integration. Say you're against liberalism. So they, instead of saying the N-word hurt, or instead of saying different words, you want to use the language of the people themselves to degrade the thing you're really after, which is integrated society or the advancement of women or blah, blah, blah. You don't say I'm against. Well, nowadays they actually do say they're against the advancement of women. Used to be to say it directly, but they used to. And so, you know, attacking woke is a way of attacking by proxy a bunch of other things.
Yeah. And you come to this work from all kinds of backgrounds. Mm. You've done reporting and law and philosophy. I also read that you were in a racial integration program when you were younger.
I was bused. I was in a program called Chapter 220. So I was bused as a kid. So I was the second wave of busing. So my sister was the first wave. So that was the wave where kids got yelled at. And I don't know if you ever, there's some famous video from Boston where the parents were screaming at the kids who come in on buses and that. So I was the second wave where nobody really cared. And actually what they were doing is they were moving from those inner suburbs. So rather than integrate, they would move. And the first school I was bused to, everybody, they were poor like us. They were just white. It wasn't like it was some great community. I mean, they weren't, you know, it wasn't like, you know, my high school was a very wealthy suburban school. And so, and Chapter 220 had a big impact on African-American students. You know, some people say negatively because it took kids out of the community, but it also gave me access to a type of education that ended up, you know, getting me into college, which then gets me into law school. So it was critical point for me. But yeah, I was the second wave, I think, of busing. Maybe the third, but I think the second real wave of busing. Because busing was a compromise for housing integration, mm-hmm. which a lot of people don't know. Like what was supposed to happen was there was supposed to be housing integration, which had been diverted through racist policies and opened up more opportunities. And communities were like, no, we're not going to let them live here, but their kids can come to school during the day. So busing was the compromise. But yes, I was bused as part of the Chapter 220 program.
What was the ratio, just for curiosity, of black and brown kids to white kids?
Oh, man, I do not remember. I mean, we weren't any high ratio. I mean, it was probably, I mean, my high school is big. So it was like one of those TV high schools, you know, like a campus. And the first tier of the campus had cars and the majority was student parking. So that's how wealthy the kids will destroy a Corvette and get another one by the end of the day. So you have inner city kids who don't have a lot of money going to a school where people can get a car replaced at the end of the week. Right. And the faculty parking is a small area. Right. So that's the kind of school it was. I don't know how many students Nicolay had. I'd have to look it up, but let's say it was 500. It was definitely more than 10%. I mean, but it wasn't like 30% or anything like that, you know, somewhere around maybe 15-20% students. Yeah.
And I know we'll talk about this later about merit and qualification and things like that. But when you were in high school, did you feel like you had to work harder to prove yourself? How do you feel like you were potentially treated differently? Did you notice that then?
Oh yeah. It was a big issue because my high school had tracking. So they had A level. So like say for math, they had A level, B level and C level. So if you were really good at something and the rap was that all the black kids got sent to C level. I was terrible in math, you know, and I feel vindicated because all you really ever need to do is add and subtract and some multiplication. But I wasn't good at math. So I was C level, but I was in A level in English. And I would be like the only black person in the class in that level, you know, and people are like, oh, are you in this class? Yeah, I'm in this class because I, you know, tested into A level for English. So you would see few black kids in A level, but you would see more in B and C level. So that was a issue right there. And then now we know the testing is a question. And when it comes to math, that's a different subject. I mean, you either know what you're doing in math or not. But for some of the testing, like the English class, the questions in the tests, just like the SAT, many of those questions are culturally based. So I was a really big reader, read a lot as a kid. And so I had a very big vocabulary, I guess. But in looking back, it may not be that some of the Black kids who weren't in A-levels shouldn't have been in A-level. It's just mm-hmm. that the testing tested cultural things. There's an example I give in the book, you know, a regatta is to a yacht as a running is to a race. Well, if you don't know what a regatta and a yacht is, that doesn't mean you're not good at English. It means mm-hmm. you don't know those cultural references. So, you know, that's a question I now have as an adult about what that testing looked like for many of the other students, right? So yeah, there was clear delineation around that. Mm-hmm.
There's also potentially not being good at test taking or the
test. Oh yeah, sure. Just that basic piece of it. Yeah.
The mm-hmm. test not testing people in the best way. So when you were growing up, I mean, you probably couldn't foresee that you would be talking about race and be doing the work that you do, but were there any things that you remember that, you know, you were the person saying, like, why is this happening?
Oh, I could foresee that. I was always like this. So when I was in high school at Nicolet, I entered a Voice of Democracy contest. And so you had to record for Voice of Democracy for the VFW, Veterans of Foreign Wars. It's like this program and you get a prize or something. And it was like, what do you think the greatest challenge for America will be in the coming years? And and this was reel to reel. So you had to do it on a reel. Mm-hmm. And I had to go to some studio to do this on a reel and then send it in. And mine was the ability of the United States to address racial integration in a real and substantive way is going to be our greatest challenge. And I was in high school. So yes, I've always been this way. But, you know, and I think that comes from my parents. My parents and my mother's family was very, my mother and her siblings and my grandparents' house would talk about all the topics of the day. And they're very like engaged in what was going on. And I think my parents, though they had a lot of faults, they also were very aware of race and history. And so contextually, I had a lot to draw on, and then I became interested in these things myself. But yeah, mm-hmm. no, but from veterans, and I didn't come in first. I came in second. They did not. Mm-hmm. And I was right. I was right then and now. So.
And did your parents talk to you about the civil rights movement?
Yeah, you know, tangentially. And my father was a union activist, you know, so I was in a union family. Both my parents were in unions in Wisconsin, so very working class union. So there was a lot of awareness that people had worked really hard on my behalf. And then, like I said, then from that knowledge, I read about a lot of things myself and was just always very much aware from the time I was a kid that people had put themselves on the line and worked hard for themselves. I mean, they wanted a better life, but ultimately what they did led to a better life for me. Mm-hmm. So that was made very clear. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we talk a lot these days about like DEI and adding justice or belonging mm-hmm. to that. And mm-hmm. there's this big movement to not do this, to not do DEI, to not fund DEI. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's your thought on that? Like, where are you at with the state of that in America? Mm-hmm. And that could be the war on woke, or that could be just,
yeah,
which is the stupidest thing, the war on woke, but
go to sleep. They might as well say go to sleep so we can sleepwalk you to your doom. Yeah. I had a call with Reuters today with a reporter from Reuters about the state of DEI. So actually just was talking about this. You know, on a very practical level, I always like to remind people that diversity is a word and that we don't actually exist without biodiversity, a genetic diversity. You know, like diversity is literally a word and it's a word that's rooted in our very existence. So how are you anti-diversity? That would be anti-life, like, right? Life, genetic diversity is how we are alive. Biodiversity is how we live. Gut diversity, apparently, you know, like we need all this diversity. So fundamentally, I'm unclear in how you're going to wipe out diversity. You see, so this mm-hmm. is a real verbal quandary that people, one of the things, like I said, all the way back to you know, scallywag and whatnot, is the folks who are against a diverse, equitable, inclusive society are really good at rhetoric. They're really, really good at it. And they walk you into an intellectual trap, and then you use their premise on the way in, and then they shut the door, right? So who seeds that diversity is bad? Why would you seed that? But people say, oh, no, I seed what? Diversity is bad? Equity is part of our fundamental premise as a nation. It's actually why we have a criminal justice system for the indigent, for equitable representation. And inclusion is e pluribus unum. I mean, it's so...
It's a social contract of America.
Right, right. Yeah. It's so confusing that people allow them to verbally walk you into this trap. Now, what they are doing is using false premises. DEI means unqualified people. There's no indication it's ever meant that, other than you assume that people who are different than you are unqualified. So you bring that interpretation, and then people argue from that interpretation forward, which is nuts. So this is on a practical matter. On a applicability in the workplace, I think diversity, equity, inclusion as a concept is, especially for an international corporation, I don't know how you run a business that is international corporation and you don't consider the diversity of your staff. You have people in India, they have certain holidays, you have people in France, you have language differences. I'm unclear on how you can run a business without considering diversity, equity, inclusion. Like, that's weird. But as a modality, it's not illegal. DEI isn't affirmative action. There's no legal requirement. There's no standards of DEI. That's bananas. It was really about how do we in workplaces apply what we claim we stand for, and how do we figure out what blockages are blocking the advancement, hiring, and retention of people from different backgrounds. What's the problem? That's literally all it is. And it is, how do we set some kind of floor as to, we want to make sure we have representation. What does that look like? Now, the EEOC and Title VII actually allow companies to look at their community and look at representation and see if there are blockages in that representation. How can you recruit and outreach? It's not, oh, I'm going to have 4 black people and 2 white people and 6. It's never said that. And that's, affirmative action never said that, does not say that in the sense. It's more about, and so that's what DEI was. How do we reach out? I want to make sure we have representation. Why would, because the truth of the matter is, if we're looking at what's unfair is that, you know, white men, let's say, are 40% of the US population or something like that, but they're 80% overrepresented in every what's called a good job, jobs that make certain income. So how is that? How is one group representation so overrepresented? That's the questions that people were starting to ask with DEI, and power does not like to be questioned.
Yeah. And well, they'll tell you, you know, those are merit hires, but similar to the Trump administration, I don't really see a lot of merit. So
No.
So talk to me about that. Like, the, you know, is this a DEI hire? Is this a merit hire? How people are categorizing those?
Yeah. You know, so in my book, Qualified, How Competency Checking and Race Collide at Work, I talk about this. I have a whole section about this. Merit as a concept in the United States only starts to come into any kind of focus once out groups try to get in. So for most of US history, the way you get hired, for if you're upper class, wealthy, we're talking, and for the most part, we're talking about office jobs, management jobs, people, everybody has always worked. Enslaved people, women in the home, people, everybody's always been working. But we're talking about professional access. These jobs were passed among the wealthy and well-off and well-known. You know, back in the day, people write a letter, you know, dear Thomas Jefferson, please consider my cousin as an apprentice, right? It's like a referral. It actually, when you think about the way most hiring was done, it was referral-based hiring. Referral-based among a closed group of people referring each other for things. And then you had another level, which would be artisans who referred people. So it's all referral-based hiring, really. And we only start to consider merit in the traditional sense once an out-group tries to get in, and that out-group is Jews. Mm-hmm. So when we look at higher education, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, all that stuff, in the book I talk about the president, which president, is it FDR? I think it's FDR, remember? Because there were two Roosevelts, right? I think it's FDR. I have his grades before he got into Harvard and his grades to test to get in and the grades at Harvard. They were all C's and D's, right? So what it was in order to get into Harvard or Columbia, you had to be mm-hmm. from the right family, and that's Protestant, wealthy mm-hmm. family. That's it. That's how you got in. You didn't have to have, and the grades at Harvard, people say, oh, it's great inflation. No. There was actually a song they sang called The Gentleman's Sea, meaning it was tacky. You know, you were wealthy. It's tacky to be up all night trying to get an A. Like, who does that? Poor people? You know, like they didn't have to do that. So as Jewish folks started entering higher education in higher numbers, they were like, whoa, whoa, whoa. We need assessments of their merit. So that is when the SAT first starts coming online. So the SAT exists solely to try to, well, they thought it was going to weed out Jewish folks, right? They were misreading the crowd. But the SAT actually comes out of something called the Military Intelligence Test, which was a eugenics race test designed to prove which a group of white people were the most intelligent. And the Military Intelligence Test was designed to prove that the Nordic race was smarter than I forget what they call Jewish folks. Is it mountainous? It's just like, it's a weird term because it doesn't seem to match, but there's another, they had like four categories for white people. So it was like the Military Intelligence Test was designed to prove that the Nordic race was smarter than Jewish folks. That's literally what the Military Intelligence Test. So the SAT's root is in the Military Intelligence Test. So these universities don't want all these Jewish people on their campus. So they come up with the SAT, pulling from the Military Intelligence Test, hoping that it's going to weed them out and show the superiority of the white Protestants, which ultimately.
At that time, did people buy buildings or sponsor things?
Of course, for universities.
Yeah.
And wealth was the entry. Well, wealth was your entry, but not if you were an outgroup. If you were an outgroup, they had to create a barrier. So the more the out-groups started to come in, the more they start to build a barrier. So merit only exists as a functional way to keep people you don't want in out and keep privilege in. So referral-based hiring didn't go away. I talk about this, 30 to, depending on the industry, 30 to 50% of hiring is still referral-based hiring.
Wow.
And that is overwhelmingly a white closed hiring system. So overwhelmingly, and it heavily favors men. So it is still that vestige is still there. So there's still that separate track for that group. And then everybody else I talk about has come in the front door. So merit only matters when it's out group. Right. And then in developing these quote merit-based standards, they use, and in the Military Intelligence Test, they said this, they use their cultural references. So you have to figure out my cultural references to get over this hump, to get in this special club I have, which I don't have to because I'm in the club and I can just call my uncle and then I get this job. Right. So we have to start there, that we never had a merit-based society, not really. And every time outgroups try to enter, we start shifting. So trade unions, when Black folks wanted to get in trade unions, oh, you got to take tests. You got to take tests. Civil service, you got to take tests. LSAT, after World War II, the GI Bill, which a lot of white ethnic men start using. So again, Jewish folks, Italians, Irish, other ethnicities, you need an LSAT before you can take the test. So every one of our merit-based testing things can be traced to trying to keep out people out of spaces and maintain advantage. So I dispute that we ever had a merit-based system. I don't, we haven't, you know?
Yeah, no, I appreciate you explaining that. Can you also talk about, and I don't know how prevalent this was, but I read that someone would say we're hiring all people and then they would code that's a Black person or there are ways of sort of like.
Doing, that happened recently.
Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about that? Like aversive racism and
how
when people say money's available or jobs available, it's really not.
Yeah. I mean, that happened recently. I wrote about that in the book with a placement firm, and they would say, you know, anybody can apply. But then when they would communicate with the client, they would put cupcakes, meant this is a Black person, Twinkie, that meant they think this person is gay. Something like that. They would put these little codes that the employer knew what they were communicating. That's what they would do. They would, so that's recent. That's not like years ago.
Yeah.
So,
and what happens with something like, was that an EEOC investigation? Was that,
yeah,
it was become a case.
Somehow it ended up being an investigation and was found out what they were doing, but under the current administration, I don't know if that would be a problem. I think they could just say it's a Black person and that would be fine. But the case was found out, but it doesn't really discourage it. You know, the assumption that merit, everybody's equal, is untrue. And if we did actually have a merit-based system, the representation wouldn't look, still, white people still wouldn't be overly, they wouldn't be overly represented. So it's not that people want a merit-based system. They only, when people are saying that, what they're really saying is, I want a system that favors me. And I want you to work harder to enter my domain. And I will decide if you should be in my domain. That's really what they're saying. But yeah, discrimination in hiring is still prevalent.
What about the other sort of tokenization of like, we need to hire a Black woman, find me one. Does that exist often? And, even if you have goals of diversity and you hire someone, if you never listen to them or give them a raise or so I think prior to this sort of war on woke, there was sort of a leaning in of everyone put out a DEI statement. Everyone looked at who they were hiring.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the hiring tokenization is multi-layered. I think in some sense, if you hire someone and you've never had a person like that, which is wild, right? So it's 2025 and people are still arguing about this. And yet we totally miss that. There are tons of industries that have never had Black and other people of color in their ranks. That's bananas. And so the question about why is that is going to lead to what happens when that person gets there. So if you hire somebody and you don't think about changing anything about your systems, it's probably not going to work. It's probably going to be that person going to feel tokenized. They're going to feel alienated. They're not going to feel included because you haven't changed anything about the system that heretofore has somehow kept out what should be a natural flow of diversity. This is the main thing I always want people to understand when we talk about diversity specifically. Diversity would happen naturally, but for. And we always have to ask ourselves, what is the but for? Meaning there are plenty of Black people with education experience who can have jobs. They're not a mystery. There's no pipeline problem other than the pipeline is blocked. And what's blocking the pipeline is assumptions about or methods of recruitment or the heavy reliance on referral. Or, you know, these are the things that are blocking what should have been a natural flow all along. So that's one of the things. And I think when you bring somebody into an environment where you've made no changes and then you just sit them there, plop, and you don't have any sense of cultural differences, code differences and how people interact. And you still have the assumption that you, what I tell people is like, if you come at this from the assumption that I'm doing you a favor, pet, pet, pet on the head, then you're not going to have result. If you come from the assumption that, oh, there are unnatural blockages and my goal is to knock these blockages out of the way so I can get the free flow of people, that's a totally different thing. If you think, oh, let me give you poor little you a job. I know you're not that smart. You're not that intelligent. You're not that qualified, but I'm going to give you this job. If that's your opinion, sure. That's not going to end well for anybody. And I think a lot of people came at it from that angle. I'm going to give these unqualified people a chance because at the end of the day, they also thought the people were unqualified. rather than to say, wait a minute, there's tons of qualified people. What about my space is not conducive to them being here? What about the process is blocking people from being here? You know, so is that?
Yeah, no. And there's a lot kind of difference. Performative nature, extractiveness, virtue signaling, all those sorts of things. What about, so someone who's Black is hired, and then I think you talk a lot about, you know, having to work harder, having to prove yourself more. Can you talk a little bit about that? So you're hired in a workplace and then, you know, you're treated a certain way.
Yeah. I mean, there's data to that, you know, and there's data I talk about in the book from the Economic Policy Institute that examined Bureau of Labor Statistics data, which showed that Black people with an undergraduate degree are chronically underemployed, meaning they're not in positions commensurate with their education. And so you see that they are showing up with the education, but then they get a job that's entry level or high school, right? Or they have an MBA and they get the second tier job, not the manager job. So there's that's happening. And that, and what we know about underemployment for anybody is that underemployment is chronic. So once you're underemployed from the start, you tend to stay, you're still underemployed like a decade later. So there's that problem. And then we know from data that evaluations that Black people are evaluated more harshly than their white peers for any mistakes. You know, there's a famous legal memo that was written with a couple of errors in it and sent to law partners, and it's the same memo, but one group of partners were told a Black person wrote it, one were told a white person wrote it, and they were told a Black person wrote it, they paid hyper attention specifically looking for errors. So they found all the errors plus things that weren't errors, and they rated the person a poor writer. And the group that got the one and was told a white person wrote, they actually did not look as hard for the errors. So they didn't even find all the errors that were there and rated the person a good writer. It's the same memo. There's no difference other than the perception that the person is Black. So, and there's some other research about this. So that Black employees have to work at a level much higher, meaning just don't miss a deadline, can't have misspelling, can't do anything wrong to be rated just not even equal to, but close to their white peers. So it's not imagination that the standards is just shifting standards model. And the shifting standards model happens to women also, where women in general find themselves having to perform at a much higher level than men to be rated just at or below the level of men. So, that places an extra burden on somebody. I was just talking to somebody the other day who mentioned they were, you know, talking to a boss and giving a critique that didn't make any sense. You know, it's like they're looking for something to ding you on, you know, so that happens.
So there's finding problems. There's also, it seems like you have to continually prove your competencies. So
constantly,
maybe someone else, the assumption is, okay, you proved your competency. You're good. We know you're competent. But with someone who's Black, it's like, keep proving.
Well, I call it in the book, it's like a combination of Groundhog Day and the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind. So it's like Groundhog Day, it resets every day, or like the, I don't know if you remember that movie, Eternal Sunshine. You just forget, like what? You did a big contract. I don't remember that. So yeah, it's crazy.
I don't know how much you talk about or know about critical race theory, but there people talk about it like it's some evil thing. Can you talk a little bit about critical race theory and like what it is and what it isn't?
Yeah. Critical race theory is the idea that we want to look at our stories and the things that are happening from a perspective of understanding the overlay of race. So for instance, when we look at, and specifically this came out of legal context, but when we're looking at discrimination of women, you can't leave out for Black women or Latinx women or Asian women their racial identity. You have to also look at that as its overlay on gender. And so critical race theory is just really like, how do we look at and examine the things that are happening to us through a critical lens, not leaving out the impact of race in history, in law, in practice? How do we not do that, right? Because if we do that, we're missing a big part of the story. If you are just looking at a discrimination case as relates to me in the workplace and you totally pretend I'm not black, that's not, that doesn't, that you're missing like a big part of what is happening. So this goes back to the Claremont Institute and the Heritage Foundation. They are so good at rhetoric, and they understood that just saying critical and race together, they could take that and manipulate that phrase into a boogeyman. You couldn't, no one can tell you why critical race theory is bad other than they think it says all white people are bad, which is not what critical race theory does. It says, let's look at things from this context. We can't leave out pieces of identity when we're trying to get at the root of what is going on. But it was so easy to be co-opted as a word, sort of like woke. It's just an easy thing. And they are simply better at rhetoric. I mean, I'm not going to lie on that.
That seems like a hateful thing, but also, is there a comfort thing? So it's like they're choosing comfort over truth. They don't want to have either hard conversations or conversations that admit that, they're either wrong or they're miscategorizing history.
Well, I mean, I think that people want to maintain power. And they're well aware that if more people investigate critically how we got here, their power might be in danger. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's really a power protection issue. It's just like woke, you know. I don't know if you remember Stephen Miller and J.D. Vance were in Union Station in D.C. and these older white women were like haranguing them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and do you remember that?
Stephen Miller called them a bunch of old white hippies. And the reason he did that is because he wanted to degrade their participation. And the reason he referenced their race is like they're also race traitors. You know, how dare you accept these other people's version of reality and not ours. Right. And so that's what I think it's really more about, is like, if poor white people ever really could stop being so vested in being white and be more vested in, wait a minute, how come we've been poor for generations in West Virginia? If they ever started asking those questions and really decided about which, you know, in the history, I talk about this in the book, Bacon's Rebellion, that kind of thing. When groups come together, the system of power fights back hard because it's a danger to power structure. So I think that's really why.
So it's part of othering potentially as well.
They know how it works. They don't want to have you or to have white people in general start to ask questions about a system that doesn't actually benefit most white people is not something people are interested in.
How much do you think is what people actually believe and what they're just doing to keep power? You know, I think of someone like Ted Cruz, who I think is smarter than he acts. There's sort of a character. Like if I do what Trump says or if I do what J.D. Vance says. So there's also the people in America that are like, I don't like black people, but I love Beyonce and I love football. I'm just always wondering, like, what's the real belief and what's the external, I'm doing this because either my family or my politician wants me to do this.
Right. Well, Ted Cruz is a different example. I think he's an example of somebody who is white as an ethnicity, but he's Cuban as ethnicity. And he is like that white adjacency chasing, which is a whole separate line of discussion of people who chase white adjacency and think they're going to get part of it. And ultimately they're not. But when it comes to white supremacy culture, I mean, I think it's so woven into our system. It's almost a cellular belief with some people. I think I don't even think they consciously think about it. I think about this book called Dying of Whiteness, which was written by two white men, which I thought was really great. And they look at guns, healthcare, and drug addiction in the United States. And basically what they say is that white people are literally dying maintaining this idea of whiteness, right? And they were talking to this one man about his had some health issues. And I never forget this in this book. And he said he would rather die than get help through Obamacare. And that man is dead today. as we speak, right? Oh, wow. So that's how deep it runs, right? And he wasn't some Klan member or something. It's this tie, and they do a really good job showing that tie. And that tie is hundreds of years in the making. So I don't know how conscious it even is and some people, in as much as it's almost like a cellular reaction.
Well, in the Obamacare thing, I mean, some people were on it, but if you call it the Affordable Care Act, they don't care about it.
Then they're for it.
So I guess I want to know, like, what led you to this work? And also, I mean, being a Black woman in America must be exhausting. I just want to call that out. So tell me more about, you know, how, I know you've a background of doing all kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I know I'm asking a bunch of questions at once. Do you ever say, like, I'm done with this? I'm tired. I don't want to be doing this.
Yeah. Well, you know, so I think the number one reason is gratitude, right? So I, like I said, as a kid, I was painfully aware, like when I learned about civil rights and Martin Luther King and the Selma Bloody Sunday and boycotts. And I just remember thinking, like, wow, like, this is such a big deal that people did this. So I feel an obligation and a responsibility to do my part. I don't think my part is like the most critical part, but you should do your part. And so I think that somehow seeped into my brain. It's like about unconscious things, but I think it seeped into my brain, and it's been a reoccurring thing. When I was in college, I was part of something called the Marquette Integrated Leadership Council, and we challenged the university about the history curriculum. And, you know, I brought together a bunch of different people of different racial backgrounds. So I've always been this way. I've always been partly this way as a person. And, it is exhausting. This administration, this second term is horrific, is the only word for it. And what was more horrific is I knew it was going to be like this. So it was like being, you know, it's like you're screaming to people, there's a monster and they're not listening and da da da. And then the monster comes and kills everybody. And it's really that feeling of being so aware how bad it was going to be, and now being in it isn't exhausting. It can be exhausting. But again, then I remember that, you know, people have endured so much more. You know, I have a picture of my great, great grandparents, both of whom were enslaved. And so I remember that people have endured a lot more, and it gives me the ability to continue, but it does feel overwhelming. You know, it does feel overwhelming. And this administration is working with warp speed and deadly precision. They're not as stupid as people think they are. This is a very coordinated attack on the fundamentals of inclusion and accessibility in this country for women, for LGBTQIA, for people of color. And they are doing it on multiple levels. And watching it happen in real time is kind of stunning. You know, and the fact that, you know, for me, I walk around sometimes and I think, why are we walking around like everything is normal? There's like literally a 10 alarm fire and people are like, oh, I'm going to go to the movies. No, this is insane. Like, you know, so there is that like push pull internally. But, you know, I guess they claim that people incarnate in life choose. I cannot believe I would choose this, but maybe I did somehow. I don't know. But it really mostly comes from a place of gratitude and obligation that I have I'm grateful for people who work for me, and I'm obligated to do whatever bit I can.
And if you had a magic wand or gold lever or whatever, so that people would care more about injustice and not about this rhetoric game. And, you know, what would you do, or how would you solve this?
Well, if I had a gold wand, I would evaporate the last election. Kamala Harris would be president. Woof, woof. You know, it just would not have happened. But more importantly, I think what I wish people understood, and I think it can be kind of hokey to always referring to Martin Luther King, but because, you know, it feels a bit reductive, but we do either live together. I think as he said something, we live together as brothers and sisters, or we die as fools or something. We, you know, our liberation is all entangled, you know, and I wish that we could feel that in our soul, you know, all of us, that your winning is not taking away from me. And that, you know, I often tell people this when I talk about DEI, like, we don't know how many jobs that haven't been created because the United States has artificially held back Black people. We don't know how much wealth you could have had, or as a white person, job you could have had, stability you could have had, businesses that could have been saved, because we have artificially held down a group of people in this country. Mm-hmm. Like, the release of creativity is not your loss. It could be your gain in another way. Like, why can't we understand that? You know, the most poignant example of that is healthcare. The reason we don't have universal healthcare is racism. That's it. And there are more white people in the United States still historically than there are Black people, which means millions of white people have died because Southern Democrats refused to institute healthcare, universal healthcare, because they didn't want Black people to have access. Mm. So this is how we're tied. There are millions of white people who have died since, I think it was, was it Eisenhower or Truman? Oh, I need my phone. I always get those two older white presidents confused, but I think it was Eisenhower or maybe it was Truman. Somebody will correct me on this on the podcast, but who tried to get universal health care. I'd come back from World War II, had seen that they were doing it in Europe, and legitimately the Southern Democrats, who at the time now have become the conservatives, said they didn't want Black people they didn't want to have to go to hospitals with Black people. They didn't. Now the medical association also had concerns about universal health care, but that could have been overcome. But race was the determinant factor, which means millions of white people have died because they didn't want to just share a hospital building with Black people. Yeah. So that's why when I say our destinies are tied and our liberation is tied, like literally life and death tied. And so if I had a wand, if I could make people feel that and know that and remove this barrier, then that's what I would do.
Yeah. I think it was Eisenhower.
I get those two confused.
But also this makes me think of with DEI, with white women who, you know, DEI is also pregnancy related and all these other things. So what do you say to people who want to know how to solve these problems? Obviously you can't solve them all, but I mean, is it like, keep working hard, have hope? Like, what's the...
Well, I want to follow that thread about white women just for a little bit, because, you know, white women are the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action, not Black people. And it's not that people go around saying all white women are unqualified. Now, they want them out of the workplace and make them have babies. That's a different conversation.
That's a whole other thing.
Thing, right? But it's not that people are saying they're unqualified. And yet they are, in fact, the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action, bar none, outpacing everyone else, because that was the compromise to pass affirmative action, that women be included. And then white women, you know, if I got to hire this oppressed group, I'm going to go with a white woman. Well, the problem that happened is white women became totally divorced from that they saw their advancement as their own individual hard work and da da da. And they, even when people talk about Title IX, it was Title IX of the Civil Rights Act, right? But they don't feel connected to civil rights, and thus went on this journey of access that they felt entitled to as white people, and not ever reflecting back to that. And then you see people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, who are like, Republican men are sexist. What's going on? I'm like, where do you live? But she's really indicative of this mindset that I'm not a part of civil rights or DEI. I earned my merit. Yes, you earned it because you had the opportunity because of affirmative action. Yeah. Otherwise, you would not even have gotten in the door. So there's, you know, this huge disconnect from white women to telling each other their story about how they got here and how it ties back to civil rights has been a real breakdown of allyship, because it hasn't created any real allyship, because white women see themselves, many of them, more aligned with white supremacy culture. And yet every advancement they have, Amy Coney Barrett, all these people, they don't exist in these spaces without civil rights legislation, without affirmative action, which is not about merit. It's about access. And so, and for them to then turn their backs on that and actively fight against it. And then you have Marjorie Taylor Greene being shocked, I tell you, when she finds out that sexism and patriarchy does not include her, that apparently they have these meetings on the Hill that don't include any of the women. Well, I could have told
where
you that.
They been? Yeah, where they been?
Yeah, but she never saw herself in this epic, in this story like this. So there's that. But what can people do? I mean, I think people have to speak out. They have to call out what they see. They have to challenge their workplaces. Why do we, what's our referral-based hiring position? Can we reduce, you know, I talk about this in the book. Can you reduce your referral-based hiring? If you, if it's 15%, can you bring it down to 5%? And then can you look at your front door system, the system everybody, is AI blocking people? What's blocking? What's your flow? You can do that. And that's not EOC. And that's not DEI. And that you can do that. That's something you can do that actually will immediately shift who gets in your door. So there are things that people can do practically speaking. And then, you know, I know people feel like asking people to vote is unfair, but there is something afoot. Tennessee came so close. You've had small elections in this deep South where things that haven't happened in 30, 50 years with Democrats moving in position that have happened. I think people are primed. I think that's why they're running scared and they're trying to change the ground rules and try to jerry-rig the voting because people are ready to vote in the midterms like their lives depend on it because they're, I think our very lives do depend on it. And that goes just back around to that memo that came out, the terrorism memo, which basically everybody's now a terrorist if they say so. Literally, if they say you're a terrorist in the United States. And that includes anti-American ideology. That's in that memo. What I am saying is apparently anti-American ideology, though I think it's just simply part of our history. Mm-hmm. Now,
and contrary to your First Amendment rights.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you follow that to its logical conclusion, they're blowing up people in the water, Venezuelans, because they say they are terrorists, which means that any of us who are identified as terrorists under that could also be subject to extrajudicial killings. I don't think that's a far leap. So when I say people need to vote, and if it's not a big issue in your area, can you go help in an area like your lives depend on it? Literally, I think lives depend on this midterm vote.
Great. Well, I thank you so much for doing this interview, but also just for the work you do every day.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. And how can people find you, follow you, buy your book?
Oh, I'm everywhere, man. The main thing is my website is S-H-A-R-I. That's how you spell my name. No E. D-U-N-N. So if you look that up, you're going to find my book, Qualified. You're going to find my Substack. You're going to find my LinkedIn. You're going to find everything just by looking up S-H-A-R-I-D-U-N-N. And it's my website is my name.com. So thesherrydunn.com. So you can find everything. So I'm on LinkedIn, Substack. And my book, Qualified, is available on Amazon, everywhere books are sold.
Yeah. And you're working on another book.
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm trying. We'll see how that goes.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it looks like we've reached the end of this episode of All American Why. If you made it this far, congratulations. You're officially an excessive thinker, too. If something today made you laugh, cringe, or reconsider everything you thought you understood about this country, good. Well, that's the point. Subscribe, rate, review, and share All American Why wherever you get your podcasts, including on YouTube. Or don't. It's still a free country. For now, you can find me, Michael Jonas, on social media or at allamericanwhy.com, where we're building a community for people who still give a damn. All American Why is recorded at Sasquatch Media Grounds in Vancouver, Washington. Original music by Renezra and Views. Audio editing by Kyle Gilmore of Residual Audio. Until next time, keep your curiosity loud, your optimism spiteful, and your democracy under constant surveillance. This is All American Why. Thanks for listening.
All American Why. All American Why. All American Why. Ask yourself the American Why.